Welcome to Counterpoint. I'm Jonathan Judaikin. With me today is Jonathan Sarna, a distinguished professor at Brandeis University, arguably the doyen of his generation among scholars of American Jewish history, the chief historian of the National Museum of American Jewish History, the author, editor, or co-editor of more than 20 books, including his acclaimed American Judaism. Today I'm going to be talking to him about his most recent book, When General Grant Expelled the Jews, and the volume he co-edited with his student, Adam Mendelsohn, Jews in the Civil War. Sarna is also the main expert who provides the historical perspective for the recently released film on PBS, Jewish Soldiers in Blue and Gray, available from the National Center for Jewish Film, if you miss it on PBS. Jonathan Sarna, so good to have you with me on Counterpoint.
It's a joy to be with you.
Jonathan, before we turn to the specific story you tell about General Grant and his infamous order to expel the Jews issued in the midst of the Civil War, let's set it in a bigger context of Jews in the Civil War. Tell us about Jews in America on the eve of the Civil War. How many? Where did they come from? Where did they live? How long had they been in America?
The Jewish community has grown enormously in the decades prior to the Civil War. To give you a sense, there probably weren't more than 3,000 Jews in America in 1820, 15,000 in 1840, 150,000 on the eve of the Civil War. Of those 150,000, probably only about 25, 30,000 were in the Confederacy, the rest in the Union. Most of these Jews were therefore new immigrants, most of them Central European, from what would later become Germany, Poland, some from Holland or England. Many of them had been peddlers when they started. Those who were successful had moved up. They were merchants. And that probably played a role in the story. They were easy to spot. They maintained their accents. They looked a little different from people who had been in America for generations.
Now, one of the other longer-term backdrops to the story about the Civil War is, of course, the larger history of slavery. And one of the things that I liked about the documentary Jewish Soldiers in Blue and Gray was that it opened the film with the differing views on slavery within the Jewish community. Like everything else, this wasn't a settled matter. And it still really rattles my mind that the right-hand man of the Confederacy was Judah P. Benjamin, a Jewish slave trader. He's a fascinating figure in his own right, but can you give us a broader view on the role of Jews in slavery, as well as Jewish communities' commitments to fight against slavery, or Jewish individuals' fights against slavery?
On the subject of slavery, Jews did not differ from their neighbors in the United States. The entire range of views from abolition to pro-slavery can be found among Jews. You had a small number of Jews who had actually been slave traders back when slave trading was permitted. The history of slavery in the United States would have been identical even if no Jews had been there. You had early Jews who opposed slavery, some of them quite vocally. And then you had Jews like Judah Benjamin who owned plantations and Jews who defended slavery. There were even New York Jews who had close economic relations with the South and who had come to believe that their economic welfare was tied in to the South's well-being, and the South's well-being depended on slavery. The best line about Judah Benjamin was articulated by a member of Congress who described him as an Israelite with Egyptian principles. Even rabbis disagreed about slavery. Some rabbis said, well, slavery must be okay. It's in the Bible. It's even mentioned in the Ten Commandments. Yes, you have to rest your slave on the Sabbath, and don't covet your neighbor's slave. That proves slavery is legitimate. Others, of course, felt that the whole tenor of the Bible, the whole spirit our biblical religion went against the idea of human beings owning other human beings. So even on the matter of how the Bible viewed slavery, Jews were divided, much as the nation as a whole.
It's still incredible to me that you have Jews who, on the one hand, celebrate Pesach, Passover, this ritual that's all about liberation from slavery, and on the other hand, you have slaveholding Jews. So just give us a little bit more on Judah Benjamin. He's such a fascinating figure, and it's so interesting that he came to be the perhaps the second most important person on the side of the Confederacy.
Judah Benjamin is a fascinating figure. His father had been in Charleston and actually had been a part of the group that left the synagogue and had become reformers and clearly had moved away from traditional Judaism. Judah Benjamin goes off to Yale College, as it was then. He leaves under somewhat mysterious circumstances, but eventually becomes a lawyer and indeed one of the finest lawyers in the country. He is offered a Supreme Court justiceship, which he turns down. That would have made him the first Jewish Supreme Court justice instead of Louis Brandeis. He does become a congressman, then a senator from Louisiana, one of the earliest Jewish senators. He marries a non-Jew, brings his children up in the mother's faith, but he himself remains Jewish and I think believes deeply in the cause of the South. He befriends Jefferson Davis, is close to Davis and his wife really throughout the war and at different times, is Secretary of the Treasury, Secretary of State, really playing a central role in the Confederacy, perhaps from fear that there would be widespread anti-Semitism directed against him. After the war, Benjamin is one of those who escapes and actually makes his way to England. And there he resumes his career as a lawyer, what of course the British call a barrister. Has a fabulous career, writes a very important work on the law of property, never returns after the war to the United States.
Had he returned, he might well have ended up being lynched in the post-war South. But with that story and with the larger background set out somewhat, let's actually turn to when General Grant expelled the Jews. In the introduction to that book, Jonathan, you tell the wonderful story of how talking about that subject almost ended your career as a professor. Tell us what happened.
When I was a very young beginning professor, I was invited to give a talk before the board of overseers of where I was then teaching in Cincinnati at the Hebrew Union College, Jewish Institute of Religion. It was the anniversary, the 120th anniversary of Grant's order. There were new papers that had become available, and I thought I would tell them about this order expelling, quote, Jews as a class from Grant's war zone, the only time Jews as a class have ever officially been expelled from anywhere in the United States. And I prepare my talk on the basis of these new documents and the Grant papers. Everything seems to be going well until I reach the subject of smuggling. Of course, Grant was deeply concerned about smuggling between the North and the South. He thought that the fastest way to win the war would be a full-scale siege of the South. Smuggling perturbed him greatly, but I pointed out in the lecture that we now know that smuggling was very widespread. Yes, Jews were engaged in it, but all sorts of people we know were engaged with it, including, I said, Grant's own father, Jesse Grant, who we now know had a clandestine scheme cooked up with the Mack brothers of Cincinnati. The Macks were in the clothing business, undoubtedly needed cotton, and they cooked up a scheme with Jesse Grant whereby he would obtain permits to move cotton from the South to the North, obtain the permits from his son, and help them get the cotton to New York. He'd get 25% of the profits. No sooner were those words out of my mouth than all the chairs began to stir uneasily in the room. And my mentor, the great historian Jacob Rader Marcus, buried his head in his hands. I knew I'd said something terrible, didn't know what it was. Hobbled to the end of that lecture, and a man, an old man in the front row, immediately raises his hand. I point to him, he rises to his feet, and announces, "My name is Mac. That was my great-grandfather you were talking about." And then there was a long and dramatic pause. "It's all true." And at that point, everybody looked up and smiled, and Dr. Marcus breathed a sigh of relief, and I guess my job was secure. Of course, what I learned from that was that there was a family tradition that preserved the story of this scheme between Grant's father and the Macs, but they were very secretive about it. Indeed, he had never told his own children about the story, but clearly he knew that it was true. It took me a long time to get over that experience, but for the 150th anniversary of the order, which is this year, dusted off those notes and decided that there's really a book in this story of when General Grant expelled the Jews. And that's really the genesis of the volume that I produced.
And in that book, one of the things that you do is really say that this moment of the encounter between the Macs and Jesse Grant, when he brought this proposal to his son, Ulysses, that this is really what ended up triggering the order. But once more, let's put it into a little bit of a larger context, Jonathan. And in Jews in the Civil War, which is a fabulous collection, Ellie Evans eloquently sets the stage for General Orders No. 11, which was, as you've already alluded, the most sweeping anti-Jewish regulation in all American history, issued on December 17, 1862. This is how Evans sets the stage. He says, "The South lay in ruins, decimated by fire and plunder, its ports isolated for years by blockage, its factories turned to charred rubble by a deliberate scorched earth policy, its money worthless, and its economy in turmoil. But in Memphis, thousands of bales of cotton sat in the warehouses, half hostage and half gold." And you write in your monograph, "Speculative opportunities multiplied once Union troops moved into the Mississippi Valley in 1862, capturing Nashville, New Orleans, and Memphis." This is the scene. So why did General Grant issue Order No. 11? What's going on in the Civil War that sets this order in motion?
I think that, as so often the case, there is a cause and there is an occasion. The cause, unquestionably, is smuggling brought funds to the South. They used those funds to purchase arms. Grant, who was a deep believer in sieges and is at that time moving on Vicksburg, believes that if smuggling could be ended, then the war would be ended shortly thereafter. And he and Sherman consider the smugglers to be the worst kind of traitors. And one can really see in Grant's letters that for months he's been worried about smugglers, and to his mind, the word smuggler and the word Jew are practically synonyms. All smugglers in their minds were Jews, whether they were Jewish or not, and there's no question that some of those smugglers whom his troops caught were Jewish. But I don't think that Grant was yet ready to expel Jews as a class from his war zone. And indeed, just a little over a week before he issued General Orders No. 11, he overturns an order from one of his subordinates who had wanted to expel Jewish traders from a much narrower area around Holly Springs. So you wonder why, if he overturned that order, does he himself issue the order? And I think the reason is that when he saw that his own father was engaged in this kind of scheme with a Jew, we have several eyewitnesses who say that he exploded and decided then and there to expel Jews as a class. In a sense, he expelled the Jews rather than his father, that kind of displacement. But I think that the incident just triggered this response that suggested to him that the way to end smuggling was to be rid of the Jews, whom he saw as the core of the problem. We know that many of his own troops were smuggling, and that there was so much money to be made moving cotton from south to north, and foodstuffs and medicine and clothing from north to south. There was so much money to be made that pretty well anybody who could smuggle did, by no means a Jewish monopoly.
If you've just turned on your radio, you're listening to Counterpoint, and I'm Jonathan Judaikin. I'm talking to the renowned historian of American Jewish history, Jonathan Sarna, about his newest book, When General Grant Expelled the Jews. Now, Jonathan, one of the things that's going on really on both sides, North and South, is a real elevation of anti-Jewish sentiments in this period. Really, for both sides, the Jews become the scapegoat, a useful foil to blame what's going wrong on either side on the war. And I imagine that Judah Benjamin being such a prominent figure was a real lightning rod for this in part. Tell us a little bit about anti-Semitism in the context of the Civil War and the way that this was, for a short while at least, quite a watershed moment as far as anti-Jewish sentiment was concerned in the United States.
Wars tend to breed hatred, and obviously there was a lot of anti-black sentiment, anti-Irish in the war. But in addition, there was a great deal of anti-Semitism, much more in volume and also more blatant on both sides than Jews had seen previously. Many people blamed Jews for smuggling, for economic problems, for foodstuffs that were bad, for weapons that broke down before they should, for clothing that was inferior, and the like. Jews became a convenient scapegoat. Like a lot of scapegoats, there certainly were Jews who were clothing manufacturers or who were engaged in smuggling, but Jews were broadly blamed for the sins of a few, and one can find deep anti-Jewish rhetoric in the papers of generals in the North and the South, and in general newspapers, where one finds a very disturbing amount of anti-Jewish rhetoric. And even in the Confederacy, there are people who blame all of the South's woes on the man they call Judas Iscariot Benjamin. They use him as a scapegoat, and he knows it. There are people who would like to ban Jews from the Confederacy. But the only person who actually issues an order barring Jews as a class from this war zone is, in the end, Ulysses S. Grant.
Now, despite being an infamous order, it's useful to see what the repercussions of it actually were. You write that, in fact, in the end, only a few Jews were seriously affected by General Orders No. 11. A fortunate communications breakdown and Abraham Lincoln's prompt decision to revoke the order greatly limited its impact. So tell us, why did communications about the order break down? And then tell us how Lincoln responded when he learned about General Grant's order.
It took me a long time to figure out why weren't more Jews expelled. Memphis was one of the largest Jewish communities in the South. And I would have expected, after such an order, that thousands of Jews might have been expelled. So it was a real mystery until reading through what's called the official record of the War of the Rebellion, all of the records from the war itself, I realized that very soon after Grant issued that order, his troops were surprised by a raid from a Major General Earl Van Dorn, and then additional raids by Nathan Bedford Forrest. And they did vast damage to Grant's headquarters, but in addition, and most importantly, they tore up 50 miles of railroad and telegraph lines. And that really was the answer to the mystery. because all of those telegraph lines were cut, the news of Grant's order spread very slowly. It also explains why nobody in Washington knew about the order. And indeed, it took 11 days for the order to get just from one end of Grant's territory in Holly Springs to Paducah, Kentucky. And it's only when the order reaches Paducah and the 30 Jewish residents of Paducah are expelled that we begin to see the larger, first American Jewish and then American community learn of the order. And one of those expelled from Paducah, a man named Caesar Caskell, races down to Washington. He had been a strong Union supporter, ironically, and since he couldn't get any satisfaction from Grant, he decided he was going to go and complain to Abraham Lincoln. And he rides through the night and gets to Washington and actually does get ushered in to see Abraham Lincoln. He made a wise connection with a congressman who gets him in. And Lincoln, of course, doesn't know anything about this order because he's never seen it. And Lincoln listens, and we have a later report of a wonderful discussion between Caskell and Lincoln, which reminds us how often Americans link Jews to ancient Israel and America to the Promised Land. So according to this, Lincoln says to Caskell, "And so the children of Israel were driven from the happy land of Canaan." And Caskell cleverly replies, "Yes, and that is why we have come unto Father Abraham's bosom, asking protection." And Lincoln replies, "And this protection they shall have at once." Whether or not the conversation took place exactly as it was later remembered, there is no doubt that Lincoln commands the General-in-Chief of the Army, Henry Halleck, to countermand General Order No. 11, and telegram goes out with interesting wording. It says, "If such an order has been issued, it will be immediately revoked," a further sign that nobody in Washington had seen the order, and many of them wondered whether it could possibly be true. But of course, it was true, and we then have subsequent telegrams from Grant's headquarters announcing that the general order expelling Jews is hereby revoked. And with that, Jews are, of course, allowed to go back to their homes. And in a sense, one might have imagined that the whole episode would have ended, except, of course, that there is a brief national debate in 1862. And when Grant runs for president in 1868, this order becomes a major point of contention and a major election issue.
How did it come up in Grant's election for president? It was really the Democrats at the time, who are, of course, the pro-slavery party as opposed to the Republicans, who raised this issue as one way of tarring Grant's record. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yes, in 1868, the Democrats were looking for a way to tarnish the reputation of a man who by then was a great national hero. In 1862, it was before the Battle of Vicksburg even. Grant was just one more general, and by 1868, he was the hero of Appomattox. He's the man credited above all others for a victory in the war. And suddenly the Democrats come upon this order and they see it as a stain on Grant's record that they can exploit. And so the order is reported on all over the country. We have a copy of the book that the Democratic Party distributed to those who were sent to make stump speeches. And it says quite a lot about General Orders No. 11 and how those on the stump speeches who were trying to drum up support for the party should talk about the order and what it said about Grant and use it as a way to tarnish his reputation. of course, they didn't hide from the fact, the Democrats, that they were openly racist, that they wanted to undo Reconstruction-era laws, that they disavowed black votes. They said that an African-American cannot be a Democrat. And what that meant, really, was that from the point of view of Jewish Republicans, they had a real quandary. On the one hand, many of them recoiled from the policies of the Democrats. On the other hand, how they thought, can we vote for a man who would expel Jews as a class from his war zone? And what we see is a huge debate within the Jewish community on whether Jews should vote against Grant or whether they should vote for the party that's better for the country, even though they didn't like the man who had been bad to the Jews. And it's really the first time that we see a Jewish issue as so central in a political campaign, and the first time, to my knowledge, the Jews had this kind of internal debate on whether, when we go into the voting booth, do we vote as Americans and totally disregard our Jewish interests? Or do we vote as Jews and say we cannot vote for a man who is bad for our group? Or how do we balance those two sets of interests if they seem, as they did in 1868, to be in conflict?
Now, one of the other things that it seems to me is also in conflict was the question of the Jews' relationship to blacks. One of your themes is that Jews really worried a lot about their status vis-a-vis blacks in America. They worried that if the status of blacks would appreciably rise, then the status of Jews would correspondingly fall. So racism and anti-Semitism have a linked but also a cross-cutting history in America. Can you give us some sense of how these kinds of issues have been balanced over the course of American history?
In 1862, at the time of the order, we have to remember that the order comes just 2 weeks prior to the Emancipation Proclamation. So many Jews drew the inevitable conclusion that, we're now emancipating blacks and the new outgroup will be the Jews, imagining that if the status of one group rose, the status of the others would fall. And the juxtaposition of General Order No. 11 with the Emancipation Proclamation certainly seemed to grant ammunition to that idea, even though in retrospect we know it's nonsense. I was astounded that I found several Jewish newspapers and Jewish leaders who articulated that fear. Later on, though, I would say under Grant's administration, it was very different. And even in the election of 1868, there were many Jews who deeply believed in Reconstruction, in giving new opportunities to blacks, Jews who had deeply opposed slavery and who supported the idea that America was really born again after the Civil War, that it was, so to speak, a second American Revolution, and that now blacks should be given every opportunity. And those people, as felt that their Jewish values mandated their support for the Republican Party, regardless of what Grant might have done years earlier. And actually, Grant as president openly and publicly linked the idea of giving new rights and opportunities to blacks with new opportunities to Jews and also, by the way, to Native Americans, and really had a sense as president that he should bring all of these groups into his administration, which he tried to do. By the time we hit the late 1860s, Jews see their status rising side by side with the status of blacks, and indeed after Grant's presidency, after the compromise of 1877, which removes troops from the South, we see not only that Reconstruction is undone and that Jim Crow legislation is introduced into the country, especially into the South, rendering blacks second-class citizens, but at the very same time, anti-Semitism rises in the United States, and we see the beginning of vast social discrimination against Jews, with Jews banned from hotels and quotas against Jews in many universities and areas where Jews are not allowed to live, and so on. After the Civil War, it's really just the opposite of what Jews had imagined. Instead of the status of blacks rising and the status of Jews falling, I think Jews begin to realize that the status of other minorities affects the status of Jews, and very clearly the status of Jews in America and the status of blacks in America are linked. And that helps to explain why in the 20th century Jews become disproportionately strong supporters of black civil rights, of the NAACP, of housing legislation after World War II. They imagined that a country that was without prejudice would be a better country, not only for black Americans, but also for Jewish Americans.
If you actually go back and look at the record of the Grant administration, this really ended up proving to be a golden age for Jews in America. And in the end, really then, part of what you tell is, in Grant's story, it's really a story of atonement. Jonathan Sarna, to appreciate the story of Jews in the Civil War era really is a different viewpoint on the Civil War. That's exactly what Counterpoint seeks to offer. Thank you so much for being with us today.
It's a pleasure to have been with you. Thanks.
Putting a spotlight on the role of scholars, academics, and intellectuals, and how their work illuminates the issues we face regionally and globally, Counterpoint is a monthly broadcast on WKNO-FM. For an extended version of this conversation, visit WKNOFM.org and click on the news menu item, where you'll find a link to Counterpoint. You can podcast Counterpoint from that website or by visiting the iTunes store and searching for WKNO Counterpoint. Counterpoint is a production of WKNO-FM in association with the Spence L. Wilson Chair in Humanities at Rhodes College. Justin Willingham produces the show. I'm Jonathan Judaikin. Thanks for listening.